Jose, welcome to Words on a Wire.
Thank you for having me.
We're here to talk about your first book of creative nonfiction. It's a memoir, and it's called House Built on Ashes. But before this book, you were known for your poems. You had two books of poems. And when I was Googling you, I ran across a poem that you wrote that they put on poetry.org. And there's a really beautiful poem about sunflowers, the difference between sunflowers from up close as you're trying to pick them, and they're thorny and they're ugly and spiteful, and sunflowers at a distance, a field of sunflowers, when you're driving at 80 miles an hour and you see how beautiful they are. And you end the poem with saying that sunflowers, they look like, quote, halos without saints to weigh them down. I love that image. That's beautiful. And I even love the idea of something being weighed down by saints, and halos are light weighed down by saints. I just love that image. And I wanted to relate that idea to the whole idea of entering into the light of a memoir, into a poem, or, you know, into whatever it is that you're working on. Is the act itself sad? Does it hurt to write?
That's a very interesting question. I think the act of writing, well, we all know, right, the act of writing is reflective, whether we're reflecting on the self or whether we're reflecting on invented characters and characters' lives, or whether we're reflecting on an object. And so I think reflection always carries with it a level of, it's solemn for sure. Mm-hmm. For me specifically, I think much of what I write is steeped in with a tinge of pain.
Right.
If only because the sort of the people and the community and the memories that I write about have kind of endured a lot of a trauma. Yeah.
Right.
Historically and communally and individually, for sure. But there's also a level of beauty in revisiting that pain, right, or that that gets me through every time. I mean, that's the whole point of revisiting characters and lives that may be tinged with sadness, is that there's a potential for transcendence.
Right, exactly. And, you know, I kind of picture, like, you know, I'm a writer as well, as you know, and and I don't know what your writing ritual is. I wouldn't like to ask about that, actually. Or maybe not even ritual, your writing habits. I suppose rit is not the right word unless you light a candle and then pray to the Virgin and then, you know.
Right.
But as I'm writing and as I picture you writing, reading this book, you have these really beautiful short passages that are almost like prose poems. And every time I enter into the language, I feel like there's this light going on and I'm beholding a scene. I'm seeing all these images and I'm following the language. And so that light is like a halo, you know, weighed down by, you know, not weighed down by saints or weighed down by saints as it is, because there is something sacred about writing. There's something prayer-like. Is writing spiritual for you?
That's another interesting question.
Am I asking too many heavy questions right at the beginning of the interview? I usually save the heavy ones for last.
No, it's all good. Is writing spiritual for me? You know, I don't think about it as spiritual. I think about it as, here's how I think sort of the most concise way of describing my writing is, it's a case against forgetting.
Mm-hmm.
Because I feel like, for sure, certainly growing up as an immigrant, and even if I get the sense, even in the society we live in, even if you're not an immigrant, there's this idea that you're supposed to, or there was certainly a push for shedding the past and embracing the future,
right,
and the future being privileged so much more over the past, as if the past, you know, just kind of falls away. And we can, especially for an immigrant such as myself, who envisioned himself as a child as this sort of wanted to be this beautiful embodiment of the American dream, that involves letting go of the past and dreaming of sort of reinventing yourself.
Right.
And now that I'm grown, I don't think that's healthy. And I don't think that's even really possible,
mm-hmm,
to let go of the past.
Right.
So It's a sense of recovery. It's a sense of reimagining, and particularly the memoir. I did certainly want to bring in the reader into the intimacy of the narrator's life and his worldview and all the big and little things that shape it. And so I was very conscious of that and creating that kind of mood and atmosphere for the reader. Hopefully so that they can sort of get a glimpse of the narrator's mindset.
Right. Yeah, I think in this memoir, The House Built on Ashes, we definitely get a glimpse into, the perspective of the narrator, which I suppose is you. We get a glimpse into the child. We get a glimpse into the teenager. We get a glimpse into the young man and how all of them think and how all of them feel. And I guess maybe that's what I mean by spiritual, because spiritual can be a very loaded word. Some people wouldn't use that word. They would use therapeutic. But I like how you do. You re-enter memories and you preserve the past. And I'm guessing that this is important to you to preserve the past, to keep the memory. What would you say? A fight against forgetting.
Right, a case against forgetting.
And maybe that answers the question that I really wanted to ask you. You're a poet. Your poetry is amazing. You have 2 books of poems. You're a very successful poet. And I know a lot of poets, and a lot of times when they write another book in a different genre, they start with fiction, with short stories, or even writing about poetry itself. But you decided to write a memoir. Why? Why a memoir? Why was that your next book after poetry?
It felt right. It felt urgent. Poetry is its own thing, and it's very kind of a different way of kind of entering experience and observation. And while I love it, I still sort of wanted to explore memory and community and home more than anything, the idea of home. When I began to write this memoir, I was still, this is years ago, I was still a graduate student, and I was far away geographically from home, very far away.
You were in New York.
And so, yeah, in upstate New York, and I was homesick, even as I have a conflicted relationship with my hometown. Nonetheless, there was a sense of urgency, and certainly with the political climate, with the kind of shift that the country's undergoing, it felt like it could resonate with readers on that level as well. And so I wanted to go in that direction. I wanted to write memoir.
When you were writing this book, and I imagine it took you, I only imagine this, I don't know if it really did, but I imagine it took you many years to write. But as you were writing it, you have these, really short passages, the language of which often reads like poetry. And in fact, that's one of the strengths of this whole book is the language. It's clearly you're a poet. And I'm wondering if on some of these sections, like just the one that comes to mind immediately is the one where the child is looking at that horse, that little rocking horse, and the description of that and what it means to the child. And you have a lot of really short, beautiful passages like that. And I'm wondering, have there been times since you're a poet, were there times as you were writing when you thought, oh, man, that needs to be a poem?
Writing prose, and then I feel like I should write it in poetry or something
like
that?
Yeah, yeah. Like as you're writing, you say, oh, my God, that's got to be a poem.
I do. And then I sometimes I'm smart about it, and I write it down or write a note down, and then sometimes I'm not. And I think I'll remember that this evening when I sit down and have time to write, and then I don't, and it haunts me. I think there are moments that kind of beg to be written in poetry. Usually when I think of poetry, I think of contradiction and paradox.
Right.
But it's fluid, especially in my notebook. I write things in longhand, and I don't, when I'm writing and taking notes, when I'm journaling, I'm really not thinking of genre at that moment. I'm just kind of writing down observations and ideas.
Oh,
and
that's a nice answer. I like that. Yeah. In fact, that answer kind of, I guess, leads to organic phenomenon of letting the work itself choose the genre.
Right. Isn't that something? I think sometimes, I am a firm believer in the idea that writers, but it's kind of hard to speak in general terms like that. Someone might not agree with me. I think that I don't have self-speaking I statements, right? I don't have complete control of language, right? Like, language is much too powerful. So I have control over it, but it also has some control over me, and it's working itself through me in ways that I may be not fully aware of. And so I'm okay with that. It makes the process that much more interesting and mysterious. What I'm aiming to do with language, and then what language is doing through me that maybe will come out later. Maybe the reader will see something in some poem that I didn't intend to be there, but nonetheless, right? It's a valid interpretation, right? The dance between the writer and the reader, right? So I'm okay with that, and I kind of like that idea.
Yeah, I like that idea too. That sounds like something a wise, developed, mature writer would say. And I'm thinking, that idea of submitting to the language, that sometimes, I'm sure every now and then you can master certain aspects, but to the willingness to submit. It reminds me of in the Paris Review, they interviewed Don DeLillo, and he was basically saying that language is like a conduit of electricity. Language is like electricity within a conduit, and language is that conduit. And what he does is he breaks the conduit and breaks sentences and releases the energy. And and that kind of sounds
metaphor.
That sounds kind of what you're saying. You're discovering. Your metaphor, not your metaphor, but the same thing is that language is something that we should be happy that we can play with it and use it. But we're never going to completely conquer it. And I love that, because that's why your work as a poet and as a memoirist is so organic. I don't find anything pretentious about this work. I don't find anything contrived. I just feel like I could submit to the language and follow you into the house built on ashes. I'm talking to Jose Antonio Rodriguez. We're talking about his memoir, which is relatively new. You have it in several sections. They're broken up in years, starting with 1992 when you were a young man, and then going back to 1978. And then each section of the book has a few amount of years that it represents, and you end with 1993. First, why did you stop with 1993? Why didn't you go all the way into 2010?
Well, I felt like 1993 is sort of a key moment in my life. A lot of, certainly, there are issues that are unresolved. I'm a young man. There's still a lot of growing to do, of course. It isn't like at age 19, I'm, fully self-aware and ready to take on the world. But there is a moment where my life took on this great sense of hope that I could have an adult life, a grown life that was different materially. Mm-hmm. And then my childhood life, which was marked by a lot of hardship and pain and discomfort in the body. I mean, sleeping was so incredibly difficult throughout my childhood.
I remember that one scene where the child, you can't sleep because it's so hot, and your mom has to fan you with a T-shirt as you're sleeping.
Right. That's like one of my earliest memories. And then we come to the U.S., and I think it's kind of be better or worse and in that way, because the house we end up living in the U.S., the first little shack, is like even smaller than the one in Mexico, and so we're like just kind of crazy crowded. And so the idea of going to college and bettering my situation is incredibly hopeful, and I wanted to end it there in a moment of hope. As far as the genre of memoir, I mean, I was very conscious of what the reader of what the genre necessitates and what it requires, especially for the reader at the end. There has to be a sense of resolution.
Mm-hmm.
though it doesn't certainly have to end in a nice little happy bow, right, where everything's perfect.
Right.
And certainly everything is not. But it felt like a nice break. If I kept going till into my 30s and 40s, I just feel like it's a whole other story. It'd be too much. I felt it'd be too long.
Right.
So I think maybe eventually, if you know, there might be a second installment.
Absolutely, and you know, you can do it now, or you can wait until you're in your 60s and write about what it's, you know, your life up until your 40s. You know.
Right. Right. And I mean, I have some ideas, actually. You know, we'll see. I have some ideas of the a narrative thread that a second installment would take, how it would be, it would tie into the first one, but how it would be its own kind of unique exploration. Whereas, you know, for the adolescent and the child, it's really kind of a struggle to survive and a struggle to find some footing and something to hold on to that, for lack of a better word, I would call hope. Whereas the second part, there's still instability and there's still doubt, but it's on a different level.
Right.
It's on a different level. And it takes on its whole kind of, oh God, the stories I could tell you, you know, what my young adulthood was in my 20s and my 30s is just, it's kind of nuts.
Well,
but
I bet.
But it's all good.
This has absolutely nothing to do with your book, and it's probably irrelevant, but I have to share it anyway. Recently, I was flying into Washington, D.C. for a huge creative writers conference, and I saw some guy on the plane that looked kind of familiar, but I wasn't quite sure, so I didn't say anything. I think he was like even one seat away from me. But then I get out on the plane, and I'm waiting for my luggage, and this bag comes by, and on the bag it has your name. And I go, that's it. That's who it is. And I see you across, you know, the luggage carousel, and I go, that's Jose. I'm going to go say hi.
Yeah, it was a wonderful moment. And again, a reminder of the small community we inhabit, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
And the few opportunities and how valuable they are to sort of find each other, right? And reconnect and nourish each other, especially in the, and so in the, again, in the climate we find ourselves in, right?
Absolutely.
Right,
let me ask you, I want to read a passage. I'm going to go back to that, that chapter about the rocking horse, which I think is beautiful. And it's an incredibly organic image that leads to multiple metaphorical possibilities. You know, it's not you don't lock it in. But there's this passage I want to read, it's looking at that horse, and I guess there's been some fire damage to it. You write, fire sometimes makes things ugly, twists them, breaks them, turns them into something you don't want, even if you know it was something you wanted before the burn. It's a beautiful passage. I couldn't help but to think of Sandra Cisneros. In fact, in a lot of the sections here, I feel that there's some influence from Sandra Cisneros. In fact, she even blurbs your book. It's a fantastic blurb. She writes, a beautiful portrayal of a world seldom seen in American letters. House built on ashes is needed, especially now. That's a beautiful, beautiful blurb.
Yeah.
It reminds me of one of the most historical blurbs I had ever read in my life when I think it was Neruda writing a blurb for Cortázar. And he says, those who do not read Cortázar are doomed.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that's quite a blurb, yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit about your influence or your affinity with, your relationship artistically with the work of Sandra Cisneros?
For sure. I'm kind of at a loss for words because her work means so much to me, right?
Oh,
as it means so much to many of us.
Absolutely.
There's a kind of a voice she inhabits that's very kind of unique to her, and it's a lovely voice, and it inspired me, certainly. It inspired me. It's sort of the voice of a child or the point of view of a child is, I mean, several writers do it, but it isn't sort of the dominant voice, and certainly not the dominant voice in nonfiction.
It's a musical voice, and perhaps the music of the voice of a child, or at least how we perceive as poets, recalling the voice of a child, we find the beauty in it. We find the rhythm. We find the music. And that leads us into, wow, incredible parts of the imagination.
Yes, and also indirectly, profound observations about how, the way the world works.
Yes.
Which the child is not aware of at that moment, but nonetheless is seeing things that are registering on some level as strange or estranging or contradictory or confusing, where the grown-up reader is like, oh, yes, this is what's happening. But the, right, even if the narrator or the child's voice doesn't know, there's still a way to communicate it through them. For example, the moment with when I am 5 years old and going to get my photo taken for the Resident Alien card.
Mm-hmm.
And this just a strange act of all that, the very idea of a camera and the very idea of sort of smiling into a machine and the card itself, you know, with this big announcement on top. And my photo and my image on this card that I have to show when I come through back into the United States. And so it's really magical. And you can do a lot with that if you can find the right balance, right, between the kind of magical childhood power of observation, childlike power of observation with a writer, of course, and the writer's awareness of the significance of children's observation.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And, you know, sometimes I read writers, you know, I work in an MFA program, and we have these brilliant writers from all over Latin America and all over the United States that come into our program. And sometimes they're just so intensely intellectual. And it's a good thing, you know, and I tell them, you're not going to lose your intellect. But sometimes I just feel like they should write from the perspective of a child. You know, and to give up the intellect and submit to that language of a child, that perception or the way they perceive child's imagination, because it leads them to much more profound statements than that they could ever make by quoting Nietzsche. And I'm thinking specifically about this book, House Built on Ashes, a memoir, that very last chapter, that very last image where the narrator, again, I suppose that would be you, is looking at the house in Mexico where his very first house that he left years ago and went to the United States. And you write, as he's standing before the house, it's not at all what he remembers. He says, that moment when I stand before the house, the remnants of it, that moment will be beautiful. So beautiful, in fact. If this were a novel, that would be the ending. The one that justifies everything that's come before it, gives meaning to all the details. That's really a beautiful passage, especially when we understand that you are basically saying this isn't a novel and that's not how it's going to end. Let me just have one more final question. What is it that you hope with the way you ended this and the way you wrote it that people will get from it?
Oh, wow. Well, I chose to do it in fragments because it was a resistance against the historical mapping of the novel and the nation state and the idea of a nice kind of happy ending where the character at the very end finds his place in society.
Some epiphany moment where my life is going to be better now.
And what do I hope the reader takes away from it? I hope the reader takes away a kind of empathy for the people of the borderlands, for one thing. A kind of understanding of the complexities of the borderlands. But larger than that, I hope people have a greater understanding of how difficult it is to find home and to investigate their own idea of home and how it's put together. Because ultimately, I feel like that's what we're all looking for, whether it's that narrator who's literally looking for a place where he can sleep, where he can feel corporeal comfort, or whether it's a place of community and love and acceptance. It's something I feel that needs to be investigated further, especially because the world is filled with unhomed people in so many ways, right? Within and without the country. And so this idea of home is incredibly crucial to, I think, to the self. Right. And so I hope when they read it, there's an understanding, there's a sense of greater awareness and a sort of self-investigation.
Well,
that's my hopes anyway.
Well, I am confident, like me, that there are going to be many readers who find a home in The House Built on Ashes by Jose Antonio Rodriguez. Enter into these homes and this language. It's worthwhile. Jose, thank you for joining us on Words on a Wire.
Thank you very much, Daniel. And it was lovely talking to you. And thank you for your kind words about my work. I love listening to this series, and I'm just kind of thrilled that I'm part of it now.
Yeah, so am I. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.